Hey, it's Dr. Gar for The Shrink Is In. And today, my guest is Erica Cates, who is the VP of Behavioral Health and Clinical and Regulatory for XR Health, which is now a combination of Amelia Virtual Care and XR Health. Erica is a US-based psychotherapist who's been working in the field for over 15 years. In addition to being an active therapist, she's worked as a healthcare executive, working both at health plans and health technology. At Amelia, XR Health, Erica manages and delivers client services, informs clinical product development, contributes to revenue growth, partners with marketing and sales teams, and develops ROI models. And now, let's welcome Erica to The Shrink Is In. Hey, it's Dr. Gurr with The Shrink Is In, and today my guest is Erica Cates, who is currently the Vice President of Behavioral Health and Clinical Regulatory at XR Health, which is really a combination of XR Health, which work with PT and OT patients, and Amelia Virtual Care that now has merged as one institution. So welcome to The Shrink Is In.
Thanks.
So here's my first question. As a clinician, and I know you've been working in the field for over 15 years, how did you come to adopt VR in your clinical practice? Because there aren't too many of us out there, unfortunately.
Yeah, actually, my story is, I think, probably a little different. So when the pandemic hit, so I'm EMDR trained. And I actually have quite a few patients all the time that I'm doing EMDR with. I have one patient who came to me in maybe 2017 and was like, I think I need to do EMDR. And she, without a doubt, an EMDR treatment plan would be good. But it took probably 2 years to get her to the place that she was ready to do EMDR. And then what happens? The pandemic hits. And I was like, well, I don't know how to do this remotely, right? Like at that time, the transition from in-office treatment to remote treatment for talk therapy was pretty seamless for most of us, I think. And in most states, we had governments kind of forcing that or making sure that we were going to get reimbursed and all that. Illinois was actually really wonderful that way. And we really didn't have any issues moving from in-person to remote, but then when it came to EMDR, it was a challenge and I really didn't know what I was going to do. And so this poor patient who was like finally ready to start, the pandemic hit. So I started looking for solutions. And at the time, XR Health, then Amelia Virtual Care, had a solution, a remote solution for EMDR. And so that is actually how I first came to the platform. I started using it with her. She had an iPad, and actually she wasn't even using the, because at the time, Amelia, and to this day, XR Health has this, we have both, like, we can send environments to a headset, but you can also send it to a mobile phone, right? And you can put the mobile phone in 3D mode. So she had an iPad and I would send the environment to her iPad. And that's how we would do the bilateral stimulation. And then from there, I just got really interested and started exploring all the other possibilities and kind of started to see how valuable this could be. Honestly, especially at a time where I couldn't be in the room with so many of my patients. And, you know, Skip Rizzo, I know we've talked about this, how Skip Rizzo talks about the value of just immersion a lot, especially around, but as someone who has a lot of patients with childhood trauma, that was kind of the next place I started using the VR, right? Was I talk a lot about the 50-yard gap between your head and your heart. And so often I will have patients reporting a horrific story to me with, right, no feeling. And how do we help create that link between the feeling and the memory? And so I started using VR a lot to help kind of facilitate that. And then I became a believer because you see 1, 2, 3, 4 patients super impacted and by that immersion, and you see their treatment progress more quickly. And who doesn't want that to happen for their patients? And so then you start using it more and more.
Right.
So that's how I came to VR.
Yeah, it's interesting. I started, Skip Rizzo actually was the impetus for me in terms of looking at VR. I don't know, maybe, I don't know, 23, 24 years ago. And at the time, it was just too expensive and cumbersome, really. So when Amelia, or Sios at the time, came out with that Samsung Gear and Samsung phone, it was like, that was the turning point for me. So that's when I jumped in. So I've been doing it really almost 8 years now. And you're right. It works very efficiently. I think I kind of laughingly say that, there are therapists out there that look at their patients as annuities. You're going to be with me for 20 years, 30 years. And so their practices are pretty much, full most of the time. But when you work with the VR, one of the things you find out is that this works very quickly. And, most of my people are kind of finished under 10 sessions. And so there's a turnover issue. And so I'm happy when people are done and they're ready to leave, but I can understand where other therapists go, ooh, where am I going to get new bodies? It's not this guarantee, because you finish with people, they get better quick.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah. I would like to think that doing the good work, word gets around. So even if you finish quick, your community starts to learn, oh, that's the therapist who helps people get better fast. And so hopefully those bodies, those patients, right, word of mouth, for every patient that leaves, you've got one coming in. But it is. I appreciate that for clinicians, it can feel threatening maybe or scary, the thought of people getting better faster, but at least from a financial perspective.
Yeah, I think from a clinical perspective, it just makes so much sense to me.
Yeah.
That if you can come up with something that works more efficiently and gets you to where you need to be, then you should adopt it. It just makes more sense, which is one of the reasons I always question, why aren't there more people, doing this? But I think it's just the lack of knowledge that it even exists. So it's really a marketing nightmare. But I'm hoping that one day when digital therapeutics or digital technologies are so ubiquitous that everyone has some kind of, augmented or virtual reality device in their home as a refrigerator or something, then this will become much more useful and accepted and adopted in more practices. But I think right now it's, on some level, we're still in the kind of wild, wild west of digital therapeutics.
Oh, without a doubt. I think especially within the world of behavioral health, and that's not just within the world of VR, right? We see it across the board in digital health solutions, specifically within the behavioral health realm. And right, there's a lot of resistance to, like, I was at a talk about AI and behavioral health, and people are really scared. And
right.
I get it. It's we're so used to working in a certain way. It's tried and true. We've been doing it, really for centuries at this point. Maybe not you and me personally, but the field, right? It's really, change can be scary. And I do think that some hesitance and some resistance is good. That's how we ensure that digital solutions, VR included, are helpful and are clinician driven and are solutions that augment and enhance treatment and don't become, scary. Don't become something where I'm talking to a chatbot who I think is a therapist and I'm saying I'm suicidal and the chatbot has a ridiculously inappropriate response. I think as clinicians, it's our duty actually to express some resistance, not all, but some resistance, because that's how we develop better products that work for everyone. You know, part of what I'm very proud of working at XR Health is that our development really is clinician and developer working together. And the clinician voice really is listened to, right? They're not developing in a vacuum. And our goal is to help clinicians do their work faster and better and in a more satisfying way. Our goal isn't in any way, shape, or form to threaten clinicians' sense of expertise, because they are the experts and this technology couldn't exist without them.
I think the issue for the most part from the clinical side is there is a technological intimidation for any technological intervention.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that clinicians are very cautious and very careful about not stepping into territory that they're not comfortable with. And so there isn't really enough clinical training in the use of digital therapeutics yet. And so that they're not going to touch stuff that they really haven't been trained in. And I know, listen, I know XR, you know, Amelia has always been offering training and listening to clinicians, which is one of the things that I like, that it's not just, you know, a bunch of techies who sat down and said, oh, here's what we're going to do, without recognizing what implications and what's necessary in the clinical experience to make it effective. So, you know, the fact that they've always listened to, you know, my point of view, so to speak, because I've been dropping my concerns and issues and needs. And some of it has kind of, you know, been there, and some of it is, like, you know, in the pipeline. And so I know it's coming. So as a long-term user of Amelia or XR Health, I have to get used to whatever transition name, you know, and being kind of, you know, an ambassador here in the United States for the product. I see it as a beacon of truth here, that this has to be tailored to clinicians, and clinicians have to have input. So
yes,
I think that's been great. But I also know, in a sense, you know, I live on Long Island. I know that my background happens to be LA, because I like that background. But I live on Long Island, and in my county alone, there are 1,000 licensed psychologists. Licensed psychologists. I can't tell you how many licensed social workers there are, or mental health counselors there are, or psychiatrists. But if there's 1,000 licensed psychologists in the county, you got to know there's probably 2,000 mental health workers, okay? I could count on my fingers how many people are using VR.
Oh, it's the same where I am. In fact, there are two of us, I believe. And I only know this because I have a patient who comes to see me, who sought me out because of VR. And he did his research and he's like, yeah, there's you and a guy in Glencoe. I'm in Oak Park. I'm in Illinois. This patient, interestingly enough, lives far closer to Glencoe than Oak Park, but for whatever reason, liked my website better. I don't know. But there are two of us, right? And I can tell you that I am on listservs with at least 4,000 Chicagoland therapists, right? So it's a very small population of users, which I think is problematic for patients. Ultimately, it's problematic for patients, especially when patients really need specific treatments that are just so much better facilitated with VR, right? So patients looking for exposure treatment, I mean, VR is, I mean, I know I'm biased, but it really is the place to be. It's,
yeah, I agree.
It's more efficient, it's more private. I can really create an environment specific to my patient's needs. And so they have two options if that's the sort of treatment they want. I mean, that's an access issue. That becomes a serious access issue.
And I think that the fact that Amelia has the capacity to do this remotely on the patient's cell phone, with you know, an inexpensive head-mounted display, makes this such a great model and opens it up for just about anybody. So listen, you know, people, you go back 15 years ago, 20 years ago, cell phones were not, I mean, they were there, but you can't like leave the house without one now. You know, it's like it does everything for you. So the idea that the cell phone turned into this, you know, appendage that we have to have, you know, if you don't, it's like, you know, glasses, wallet, key, cell phone. You know, you got to make sure you have all these things before
Well,
you leave the
and
house.
I found out recently that certain cars actually, the cell phone is the key to the car.
Yeah, it starts a car. Yeah, right.
So
So the
we're
cell phone,
really, we've become
right.
glued to our phones, which is
But
a
the cell,
problem.
everyone has a cell phone. So it's a lot different than other systems out there where you have to buy a very expensive head mounted, you know, VR goggles, you know, which costs, you know, $300, $400, $500. Everyone's got a cell phone. So it makes it much more user friendly, and almost anybody can be a patient using VR because all they need is the cell phone as the engine.
It really is a game changer. I agree. You know, in Illinois, parity laws are pretty strong and patients expect to use their insurance, right? So, you know, most of my patients, they have like a $20 copay to see me. I will say we get reimbursed quite well in Illinois. I don't know if that's because Blue Cross Blue Shield is headquartered here or what, but I'm grateful for that. But that all aside, if I were to turn to a patient and say, "Oh, in order to get this treatment, you need to buy a $400, $500 headset," they'd look at me like I was crazy, right? But with the cell phone option, and you can get, you know, a very inexpensive universal headset for $30, that they're okay with. That's like, oh, it's one copay. Okay. And it really has increased accessibility. I'm very, very grateful for that feature.
Yeah, and I think accessibility is a very important key. You know, again, you know, you're in Chicago, I'm on Long Island, but you know, if you live in, you know, Monkey Falls, Minnesota, you know, and the nearest therapist is 50 miles away, well, that already becomes, you know, a
A
way of
barrier.
diminishing the capabilities of a therapist or the idea of even going to therapy. So it becomes a block. But if you could do this remotely on a cell phone that everyone basically has, well, that opens up the doors to lots of people. But for me, again, the problem is marketing. It comes down to marketing. It's like nobody knows it exists yet. It doesn't have enough exposure in the real world for people to go, oh, I can actually use this. This is really beneficial. So, you know, when I first started, I had this woman in Colorado call me up and say she had difficulty flying and she wanted VR therapy. And I said, listen, not that I want to turn business away, but you're in Colorado. There's got to be somebody between you and me that you could go to easy. So I did find like two or three people, but she said, no, I'm coming to you. And she did. She drove out from Colorado. I spent 2 days with her. Really embedded her in a virtual environment, spent hours and hours with her, sent her home, and she's been flying ever since. But that's, I mean, it's not as bad now. Obviously, there's enough people out there that that wouldn't occur. But in 2017, that's exactly what happened.
Which is really not that long ago. I mean, it's a wonderful success story as well, this story, you know,
Yeah,
and
it
it
was.
speaks to what intensive exposure over a short period can do, right? 2 days, I imagine you were with her for many hours both
Right.
days, but now she's flying. That's wonderful. I don't think that there's, I want to be mindful of my language here, but enough awareness too of the level of impairment that folks face when they're living with a very sticky, what I call a sticky phobia, right? Something that's just so deeply ingrained. I mean, they're remarkably impairing in a way that I don't think we as a society fully appreciate on the whole, right? There's so much awareness nowadays of depression and anxiety, but people are like, oh, you're afraid to fly. Okay. No, that can hugely impact someone's life. I have a patient with emetophobia, and the level of impairment around food and eating
right.
that has occurred over the years, you know, and this is a young woman, 13. So there's also this risk, right? If we don't properly address her right. fear of vomiting,
right.
how might that unfortunately turn into an eating disorder? Not because she has body dysmorphia, at least not as a starting point, right? But because she's so scared of throwing up that she just won't eat sometimes. And I share this to just say that to me, that level of impairment is not, we don't really pause and think about what that actually looks like for someone. Because if we did, I think the idea of VR in the mental health space becomes that much more of a no-brainer.
I think that the people that I get, for the most part, have accommodated themselves and altered their lives to get around whatever their mm-hmm. significant phobia is. And they do that until it doesn't work any longer. So, yeah. So there are people who, you know, won't fly, but they haven't really had a demand to fly until all of a sudden, you know, like this person, their job changes and now they have to fly all the time. Or somebody who doesn't cross bridges, but, you know, they've, you know, adapted their lives that they don't cross bridges until something changes.
Yeah.
So I think lots of people out there, their phobia is all over the place. And I think what happens is people just adjust. It's like chiropractic, you know, it's like you adjust and adjust, and then all of a sudden you adjust too much and now you got pain and the body yeah. can't tolerate that anymore. And so that happens with these people. So people haven't gone over a bridge in 20 years because they can get away with it. Or they haven't gone yeah. in an elevator in 10 years because, you know, they avoid elevators. They avoid buildings where elevators are, or they walk up the steps all the time. And that,
well, that's probably good for their heart.
But not good for their knees.
No. Yeah.
But yeah, but then it gets to a point where, well, you know, I have to go to the 26th floor. No, I'm not. That's a hall.
Yeah.
You know, so I think that you're right. It is very intrusive and damaging in many respects, but people somehow twist themselves into a pretzel to get past it until they can't do it anymore.
Yeah.
And that's when yeah. they come and see me. Or you know, a third of my practice actually comes from other therapists who in the process of therapy, the patients say, oh, I have to fly in 3 weeks and I haven't flown in like 10 years. And I go, well, I'm not getting you there in 3 weeks. So they would send them to me and yeah. I would get them there and then send them back. I'm just focusing on this one piece. I want to get you on a plane and then I'm sending you back to your therapist to work on whatever other issues you've been dealing with because I'm
yeah.
stepping on their toes. So that happens like a third of the time.
Yeah, I see that a lot as well. I think once your name gets out there, someone who has the capability, you know, I got a call the other day. Can you deal with dogs? Mm-hmm. I have a patient with a fear of dogs. Do you have anything for that? Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. So here's my question, my last question for you. Where do you see VR and digital health going? Where do you see the trajectory for this?
So I think the reality is that digital health, especially within the behavioral health space, is and VR, neither are going anywhere. There is such a provider shortage right now that continues. I don't know if you experience it as well on a daily basis. I certainly do. It's a huge problem in Illinois. I think it's a huge problem across the country. From all the people I talk to, it's a huge problem. And just, you know, XR is global. I talk to therapists all over the world, and this problem is not US specific. There's, you know, just the world right now, I think has just really, it's like the perfect, what do they call that? Like a petri dish, right? It's just breeding anxiety and depression and
right.
trauma.
Right.
And so we're seeing the demand and need for therapy just go up and up and up and up. And we can't train people fast enough. And I share all this to say, that sort of marketplace necessitates that digital health is here to stay, whether or not we like it, just out of need. I think that the future is going to be about figuring out how to effectively triage within the world of digital health, right? And which is slightly different than in the world of VR. But what I mean by that is, how do you identify who can get a lower touch solution so that clinicians are freed up to see the people of higher acuity? And so that clinicians' time is spent in the most meaningful way possible. I say this all the time. When I have a slot open up, I might have three people on my waiting list. I'm not, and maybe I should be, but I'm not sending out a Beck's depression inventory, like, you know, a PHQ-9 and a GAD-7 and scoring them and going, okay, of my three people, this is the person with the, based on these two assessments, kind of that's most symptomatic. They're the one I'm going to see next. No, I send an email to all three of them independently and say, I have a spot opened up on Fridays at 2. Is that going to work for you? And basically, whoever gets back to me first gets the slot. Mm-hmm. And I'm sure that's how most of us work. That's, from a population health management perspective, that's not ideal. Right. Because for all I know, the person who doesn't get back to me because they are so depressed, right, is the person that really needed that slot. So I think that as digital tools get better at kind of collecting some of that data for us, that's where
like AI screeners?
I don't know about AI screeners, maybe, but some sort of ability for us to be able to triage on a much bigger level than our micro caseload, right? I really think that that has to be part of the solution, because clinicians are so valuable. And the truth is, you're never going, I'm sorry, world, lots of technology people are going to hate me for saying this, but you can't automate therapy. You cannot digitize that human experience. But what you can do is leverage technology to say, Howie really needs Erica. Rachel can wait 3 months and could do some coping skills through an app, and she might actually return to baseline and be okay, right? Like, that technology can do, and we should be leveraging it. So I think that that's where digital health will grow. Personally, I think that looking at things that can help patients between sessions, that's where digital health will grow. And then in the VR world, you know, I've been saying this for a while now. I've been saying that I dream of the day where I can be in VR and my patient can be in VR, and we could be on opposite sides of the country, and we are in a digital space with avatars, where I can see when her foot shakes under the table when I ask a question that stresses her out. And I can see a tear forming in her eye, but all in VR. That is where I think the future is going. And I've been saying this for a while, and it seemed so, so crazy far away, but I just saw a prototype. I literally just saw a prototype yesterday of our VP of engineering, a man named Xavier Rumi, looking at himself, a 3D rendering of himself in a headset. So I don't think it's as far away as I originally thought. And I think that is going to be a game changer. And not that that means that the use of VR for phobias and PTSD goes away, but that is, when we talk about someone living in a remote part of West Virginia who can't get into treatment, they don't have a car, or their car, they have a car, but they don't have enough money for gas, or whatever the case may be. Well, now they can have a full-on VR therapy session with a therapist who's 3 hours away without ever leaving their home. I mean, that's a
Yeah.
game changer.
See, my dream has always been very similar to yours, the Star Trek holodeck. Star Trek II, they had this holodeck, which they used for relaxation and but you could, it was a blank room, and you could program the room to be anything you wanted, and it would become populated with AI avatars that were very realistic. And so the idea of being able to be the therapist and have the patient in the same VR room and create the environment that either caused traumatic events or even working on like social skill interactions and or substance issues because you're creating the environment with all the triggers. All of these things that you could individually just program, boom, 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 boom,
And be
and
done.
be in there with them is exactly the way, I see it ultimately as the goal, my goal anyway. So we're kind of on the same page here about where I think things should be. I'm just hoping within the next couple of years we get there. I think the technology is getting closer and closer, but I mean, even the advent of AI, and I mean, it has its benefits. There are programs where you could do social interactions with an avatar that the avatar actually does answer intelligently and responds. And so I think we're kind of on that
We're getting
trajectory.
there. I know we're almost at time, but I so often in my trauma work will ask patients, they'll be sharing a really traumatic story, and I'll ask them to imagine having a time machine and going back as an adult now, fully formed adult, and ask them, what would you say to that child? Right? Imagine how your future world, I wouldn't have to ask them that. The child would be there.
Yeah, it's all I'm hoping blossoming very quickly. So, and I hope we're there to watch it.
Me
So,
too.
Erica, we have to stop. It's been great talking to you, and keep up your good work with XR Health. And I hope that XR Health becomes the premier company in the VR world.
Me too. And Howie, thank you for all you do and your invaluable feedback. We feel very blessed to have you as part of the team.
Well, thank you. Thank you. So until next time, this is Dr. Gar for the Shrink Is It. And